Hello, this is Meet the Writers and I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is a modern day adventurer, a travel writer and entertainer. He's been an actor, he's a motorcycle fanatic, he was a finalist on MasterChef and he's a tireless charity campaigner. He's toured the world on motorbikes, sometimes with his friend Ewan McGregor. Together, the two have produced a television series about their trips, accompanied by best-selling books charting their adventures. Charlie Borman, welcome to Meet the Writers.
You make me sound so glamorous.
Oh, but you are. You're terribly glamorous.
I'm going to have to spend the whole half hour trying to live up to the intro.
Well, listen, we're talking just over a year since you first walked again after an horrific accident in Portugal. Now, you documented your road to recovery in your new book. It's called Long Way Back, and it also reflects your life to date, starting at the very beginning with the birth of you and your twin sister Daisy.
Yeah.
Clearly you don't remember that.
Yeah, well, I was first, though. So,
that's important.
Which is very important thing as a twin. So I've got 5 minutes on her, and she came feet first. And, you know, it's quite funny because people say, oh, you're twins. And you say, yeah, I've got a twin sister. And they go, are you identical? I say, not really.
But do you have that twin thing, the kind of bond, unspoken language, that sort of thing?
Daisy and I spoke late, I suppose, as opposed to two other children. But I think because you have a twin, you're quite self-contained. So I think you can keep each other entertained for much longer. So speech comes a bit later. I think it's quite normal with twins. But as opposed to having that kind of sort of sync, we don't have that really. I mean, I think Daisy was always have had that feeling a bit more than I did.
Mm.
But I think that's more sort of for identical twins,
right,
that kind of feeling.
Right. It sounds like such an exciting childhood because your father, of course, John Borman, who is a famous movie director, probably best known for Deliverance.
Yeah. I mean, Dad's a formidable director. You know, he directed Deliverance, Excalibur, Hope and Glory, Point Blank. I mean, the list goes on. And, you know, between the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and the 2000s when he did The General with Brendan Gleeson, you know, it was a huge success. So he's been in and around the film industry and changed the course of movie making, you know, especially with Deliverance and more with Point Blank with Lee Marvin.
Now, he was doing Tarantino before Tarantino, wasn't he, really?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think Point Blank was the first sort of proper violent movie, you know, with proper fight scenes and you know, realism. Lee Marvin was really very responsible for my father going to America. Lee had seen a couple of stuff that Dad had done and really liked it. And he was huge at the time, Lee Marvin. And he said, look, John, I want you to come and direct this movie and fix the script. And so he went off to Hollywood and made Point Blank. And just at the time when Technicolor was out and it was all about color, you know, Dad wanted to do this movie in black and white and spent a lot of time on what the bad guys' suits were colored and what the good guys' suits was, so that you could easily identify the good guys and the bad guys. And it was, you know, super clever. And that kind of started a massive relationship with Lee Marvin, and which lasted, you know, they were best friends until Lee sadly passed away. But, you know, Lee was a real character.
Mm.
And, you know, he was quite a big boozer as well. And that's kind of what got him in the end, really. And it's so sad because, you know, such a great actor and could have done so much more.
He was clearly a big influence on your childhood.
Yeah, huge influence on Dad. Yeah. But there was some funny stories as well. I mean, there's one story where, you know, when Point Blank came out, it was a huge success. And they were celebrating having dinner on Malibu Pier in Los Angeles on the Pacific Coast Highway, where all those beautiful houses are along the beach. Anyway, so they're in the restaurant with my mum and my two older sisters. And Lee's gotten quite drunk. And they come out of the restaurant and Dad says, Lee, give me the keys to the car because you're drunk and you're not driving. And Lee wouldn't give him the keys, so they had this kind of tussle in the car park trying to grab the keys. Anyway, Dad grabs the keys and he runs to the car and he locks himself into the front seat and winds the window up. And my mum and sister's diving into the car as well, and Lee's ranting and raving. And he wouldn't get in the car. And then eventually he slightly climbed up onto the roof of the car and he wouldn't get off the roof of the car. And he was, you know, saying all sorts of terrible words. And Dad thought, you know what, it's only half a mile down the road. I'll just drive. And so he drives out of the car park of the Malibu Pier and turns left down the Pacific Coast Highway, which is one of the busiest roads in California. And just as he's driving around the road, there's a police motorbike coming up the other way. And of course, this guy sees this man on the roof, puts his lights on, spins around, pulls Dad over, and he parks his bike and he gets off the bike and he's walking down towards it. And of course, now Lee's attention is directly on the policeman. And you can imagine the words that he's saying, blind drunk, and with waving his fists and all this kind of, he completely ignores Lee Marvin. He taps on the window of dad's car, and dad rolls down the window thinking, oh God, here we go. And the guy leans down and into the car and he goes, sir, do you realise you have Lee Marvin on the roof of your car? And dad said, well, actually, yes, I do. And he goes, that's fine, sir. Have a nice day.
That's off he went. Extraordinary.
And there were hundreds of stories of Lee. And he was amazing. He was Daisy and my godfather. I mean, he was terrible godfather. Not a single present, nothing. Just hurled abuse at us when but he was an amazingly wonderful man. Mm. And incredibly talented.
And of course, you were in your father's movies too. He liked to cast his children.
Yeah, well, because we were free. So he said, why pay for children when I have four for free? And we were always sort of thrown into his movies. And, you know, that's what just happened. You know, we were either traveling around the world with him wherever he was making a movie, or we were at home in Ireland, in the Wicklow Mountains, in this incredible house with this river that ran through the property, and you know, so we'd be there for two couple of years or whatever, and then dad would go off and make another movie and we'd all go with him, and then we'd come back to Ireland, and so we had this kind of crazy life. Mm. Which was fantastic. I mean, really lucky to have that.
Tell me about your dyslexia, because I know that must have influenced your schooling as well as all the moving around, but you had a lot of difficulty initially with a stutter and with reading and writing.
Well, I only got a stutter when I started to learn to read. I was very lucky because we were in Europe and Ireland, you know, identifying dyslexia back in the late 60s, early 70s was almost non-existent. And I remember telling a teacher what dyslexia meant once. And so when we were living in LA at the time, I think Dad was doing The Exorcist 2, and we had this tutor, and she identified it and she got me tested. And I had dyslexia, and they were way ahead in America. So I had a really good sort of start. And then I came back to Ireland, but I was struggling. And so my father spent a huge amount of time with me over a period of a year, just reading every day, going over the same words, spelling every day and stuff like that. And then as I started to read, I started to get this stutter. Because as a dyslexic person, you have to read every single word. As someone who doesn't have dyslexia, it's mostly memory of the shape of the word, so you glide over the words, whereas I have to go stop and start every time. And yeah, it affected my thing. I had to get a dialogue coach. I had to sing my sentences. I, you know, it was complicated in school. And then when I started acting in Dad's movies, I you know, that started to give me a little bit more confidence. And I think my dad saw that, and I think he encouraged that, and he could see it. And then eventually the stutter kind of went away, but I still get it sometimes when I'm nervous or stressed. You know, sometimes I find it difficult to launch a sentence. Mm. And it can be terribly complicated.
When did your love of motorbikes start?
When I was about 5 or 6 years old or so, Jason Connery, Dad was doing a film called Zardos, and Sean Connery was in the movie, and Dad famously made him wear these nappies. That was his costume. If you Google it, Zardos and Sean Connery, you'll see him wearing these very funny nappies. And so Jason was a couple of years older than me, and we tossed around again. And then someone had left a little Honda monkey bike, a little 50cc thing, tiny little sort of small bike. And Jason made me push it for God knows how long to get this thing started. We finally got it started, and Jason was racing around, and eventually he let me have a go. And I remember sort of riding past Dad, feeling very confident in myself. And as I rode past him, Dad just put his arm out and just grabbed me by the hair and pulled me off the bike. And I was furious, and I looked at him in fury and then looked at the bike, and the bike instantly hit this barbed wire fence. Maybe I should have known then that I was a crasher, you know, because that's all I've done for the rest of since is just crash motorbikes.
But in some very exciting places with exciting people. So yeah, you've been round the world, well, a few times now, notably with Ewan McGregor. You've made television programmes about it. Mm. Various different places that you've been to. What stands out? So, for instance, I know that you spent some time riding around Africa.
Yeah, when Ewan and I first did Long Way Round, which is, I suppose, most people will probably know me for, and we went from London to New York, going east, so through Europe and Eastern Europe and Kazakhstan, Mongolia, Siberia, Far East Russia, Alaska, Canada, America. And I think some of the things that stand out on that show, because that was the first time we really did a big adventure together, was, you know, the highlights were probably Mongolia, it's pretty enormous, Mongolia. If you look on the map, it fits inside Europe, but only just. I mean, it's huge. When we were there 12 years ago, it was there was only 500 miles of tarmac road in the whole country. And most of that was in Ulaanbaatar, the capital. So it was super complicated to get through. There was just dirt roads everywhere, no signposts. And that was the start of, our, of the real beginning of the huge adventures for us. So that has a huge impact on both of us, Mongolia left. But for me, when we did Long Way Down through Africa, that kind of really held it for me. I'd been to Africa a few times before, but never riding through it. And it's such an, the most amazing continent from the north all the way down to the south, and how it changes and how the people change and religions change. And it's just an extraordinary part of the world. And so now I have a motorcycle tour where I take people on motorbikes to Africa, and we go from Cape Town to Victoria Falls, and kind of a way of introducing people to Africa. People's opinion of Africa, you know, you say, I'm off to Africa, and they go, oh, that's a dangerous place. And you go, is it? And they go, oh, yeah, it's terribly dangerous. Have you been? No. And I mean, I was in Cape Town once, and you know, when the Ebola broke out in West Africa, and my friend rang me and said, Charlie, you've got to get out of Africa because Ebola's everywhere. And I said, well, actually, hang on a minute. I said, have a look on the map, because where the Ebola is, have you noticed it's much closer to London than it is to Cape Town? He goes, oh, no, oh, my. And he started panicking about that as well. So people's opinion, and once you go to Africa and travel around Africa, you know, as long as you're not going to a war zone or something like that, it is actually, I mean, the biggest, one of the biggest places in the world now for gun and knife crime is Washington, D.C., you know, a mile from the White House. You know, so everywhere has its problems, but Africa, and there's nowhere else in the world where you can get on a motorbike and ride along and have to stop because 40 elephants are crossing the road, and then a few kudu and eland and the odd zebra and giraffe and buffalo and bison. I mean, it's just extraordinary place.
Absolutely.
And there's nowhere left in the world where animals can run free like that. Nowhere.
You have done the most dangerous race in the world. That's the Dakar. And written a book about it.
And, yeah, I wrote a book about it and a TV show. I did. That was something that I've always wanted to do. And I think if you're a dirt bike rider, you know, the ultimate race is the Dakar Rally. If you're a road racer, the ultimate race is the Isle of Man TT, which is, you know, one of the most dangerous, is probably the most dangerous road race in the world. And then the Dakar Rally is the same, is probably the most dangerous dirt off-road race in the world. And it was an extraordinary things. I mean, you know, it was like one of those things when, you know, when you, people talk about Africa or talk about places and they say how dangerous it is, and when you actually go there, it's not. Well, all the stories they tell you about the Dakar Rally are true and probably worse. And I did that, and it was quite an eye-opener.
And you survived it, but you almost didn't survive making a programme in Portugal, which is where you had this horrific crash.
Yeah.
So tell me what happened.
Well, Portugal, I was actually doing some work for Triumph, who a fantastic British company that make most lovely motorcycles and all here in Britain, and it's still a privately owned company. And anyway, so we're launching the new Explorer, which is the adventure bike, and had the world's motorcycle press there. And we were just going out on early in the morning on the second day of 5 days, and a whole bunch of journalists were ahead of me. And I was just overtaking a car, just coming out of a small town, you know, so not any great speed. And just as I overtook the car, and the sun was very low, and I remember having the sun shining in my rearview mirrors, you know, and thinking, cool, that's strong. And just as I went to overtake the car, it just suddenly decided to turn left down this little dirt road. And I kind of went with it a little bit, and then it clipped me. And then I'm not quite sure exactly how it happened, but I ended up sort of heading towards this wall. And I remember seeing this wall and thinking, oh, this is going to hurt. And then I glanced the curb, which was a very high curb. I glanced the curb, and then I think I must have hit the wall or something, and I just mangled my legs really badly, and I broke and dislocated my right ankle quite badly, and then I smashed my left tibia and fibula to pieces and just below my knee, and then broke a couple of bones in my hand. And I remember just this massive impact, like 3 or 4 huge thuds, and then stop. And I've had crashes plenty of times before, and that's the nature of riding off-road. You crash a lot. And of course, you know, you instantly try to get up and get the bike and get back on the bike before anyone notices that you've crashed. And I tried to get up, and I went up and I went to go and walk, and I just had this, my left leg was just flopping around. and in the most extraordinary position, and all these bones and everything were sticking out of it. And so I sort of sat back down again and thought, okay, I think I'll just wait. And then I remember being in true British form. I remember sort of all these people around me and stuff. And I was just saying to them, look, if you just give me 10 minutes, I think I'll be able to sort myself out and get back on the bike. And they were all going, yeah, sure. And it was clearly not going. And it was bizarre because I was lying there and I knew that my left leg was bad. And I thought, okay, well, I can deal with that. And then when the paramedics came and it just slowly, every sort of 5 or 10 minutes, it was getting worse. You know, that, oh yes, the leg was broken, but it was really broken. And then I was saying, well, there's a bit of pain in my ankle, but it's probably just, I got knocked. And then they cut my boot off, and then it was like, oh Christ, it was all dislocated and mangled. And it just was, you know, the day just got worse and worse.
Well, as did the months, because of course that was the beginning of a very, very long time, either in hospital or laid up at home. And you chart it beautifully in the book, which tells us about the accident and the recovery process. But then you look back during the book at various episodes in your life, and it's beautifully put together. And of course there are photographs in it too, which is fun. You talk, as we said, quite a lot about your childhood, about being in the movies, also very movingly about your wife.
Oh, Olivia, yeah. No, Liv is amazing. We've been together for 30 years she was at my 21st birthday. And there's a lovely photo of us on my birthday and how beautiful Ollie is. But she has been incredible. You know, for the last 12 years or so, I've been travelling for sometimes up to 7 months of the year. Not all in one time, but a lot. And she's dealt with the kids. She's, you know, with all sorts of things and never once questioned anything. And then when I had the accident, she came to Portugal and without her, it just wouldn't have worked. I mean, when I finally got home, I was stuck in bed for 4 or 5 months. I couldn't really do anything. And she did everything for me. You know, I do remember a friend of ours came over with a little bell, you know, so that I could have it. And I rang it once and she came over, grabbed it, stepped on it and threw it in the bin and said, never do that again. You know, I was like, okay. But you know, she was incredible. And then a month or so into being back at home, our daughter Dune, our oldest daughter, was skiing with her university. And on the second night she was there, she came out of a drinking establishment quite late at night and tripped over and broke her jaw. And so suddenly there was the two of us who were practically incapacitated and stuff like that. But and she just did what needed to be done with such grace. She's an amazing person and put up with it all, because it's, you know, it's hard work. It's really hard work.
Of course, it's not the first time she'd had to deal with problems like that. You had a bout of testicular cancer.
Yeah, I did. My sister Talsha, who was our oldest sister, she died of ovarian cancer 21 years ago. And she was very young, and left Daphne, my little niece, behind, who was 6 and a half at the time, who's just had a baby, actually, wonderful little boy, Leo. So when I got testicular cancer, you know, I was, because I'd seen what had happened to Tasha, and I completely freaked out about it. And luckily, you know, we caught it nice and early, and actually, it was quite funny the way we found out. Ollie was taking Ziggy to the vet.
And Ziggy's your dog?
Our dog, yeah. And he is a Springer Spaniel, lovely little fella. And he was having his annual check. And the last thing that they checked was his nuts. And he said, oh, one of these feel a bit odd. And my wife said, gosh, one of my husband's testicles feels a bit odd. And he said, well, you better go and get that checked out, definitely. So she went back and said, you got to go. Anyway, so I went to the GP, and it was funny because it was the first of many gropes after that, because he had a feel and said, yes, there's definitely something wrong. And then it's just an endless groping the rest of the time. And then before I knew it, I was sort of lying on the hospital bed, theatre, you know, about to have one of my testicles taken out. And I remember the surgeon coming in and he had a Sharpie. And, you know, they mark and you both agree as to what is going to come off or fixed. And so he came with a Sharpie and I said, listen, I better do this because this is very important that you take the right one off, you know. And he goes, okay, Charlie, that's fine. So he gave me the Sharpie, and then just as I was about to sort of mark it all up, he said, yes, but don't forget, Charlie, you're dyslexic. And so I just handed the Sharpie back to him and said, okay, you do. But anyway, but I was like, I had a few doses of chemotherapy and and I was okay. Mm. But you know, it's so important for men. Women do an amazing job of checking for breast cancer and stuff, and it's been ingrained in women, and the same thing needs to be done for men. You need to get to know your testicles, and you need to know that they both feel very similar. Yeah. So if you're having a shower or whatever it is, you know, check them on a regular basis.
And of course, this is something you're involved in because you do a lot of charity work. Yeah. Movember, which is for testicular cancer, is it not?
Yeah, it's for men's health. Yeah. And so, yeah, so it started off as sort of as more focused on prostate and testicular. And now it's very much into men's mental health and well-being and you know, all those kind of things. It's a whole bunch of things combined. Mm. I mean, hugely successful charity, well over £460 million or so have been raised, and with the money that they've raised, it's highly unlikely now that you'll die of testicular cancer. And you know, there's a huge move with prostate cancer now as well, for chances are much higher now. So
they
do good work.
You're also involved with UNICEF and a charity that is involved with dyslexia.
Oh yeah.
So all of these clearly taking up a huge amount of time, plus all your travelling, plus this horrific injury, and then the book, which, as I say, weaves in and out of your life. It's a delightful story. I wonder what you'd say you've learned from the experience.
As you go along in life, you come across all sorts of hurdles, and nothing is straightforward, really. You know, so the first big hurdle I had was losing my sister, Talsha, who, you know, it was only a year or so ago that I finally deleted her telephone number from my phone. I couldn't do it, you know, 20-odd years later. Mm-hmm. And that changes you. You know, Talsha changed things for me, and she's always been kind of around. I've always sort of feel her around me, and always think, well, wonder what Talsha would think, or that laugh that she had. And then that happens, and then, you know, you have a bout of testicular cancer. My mother died. All these things happen, and then this huge horrific injury, which, you know, is life changing. You know, I won't be the same person that I was. I can't run anymore. I still hobble around, and you know, I think I'll be back to sort of 85% of what I was. Won't ski again and stuff like that. I can ride motorbikes, which is brilliant. But all those things sort of change, and so your attitude and what becomes important to you changes as well. And, you know, it's so easy for things to change. I almost lost my leg. It was only just sort of hanging on by some muscles and tendons, so they had to put the whole thing back together again. There was a definite question mark about that. So all of these things change you, and I think we all go through that, and hopefully we sort of become a little bit, at least learn something from it, you know. Mm. But I've certainly learned with the accident and stuff, I've certainly learned, you know, not to look back and reflect at what ifs and could haves and, you know, why did that person turn left, you know. I can certainly tell you that person did not leave in the morning thinking, I want to take someone out. That's just not what's happened. It's just a mash of something that happened. And regardless of how you look at it, there's nothing will change it. So you may as well just leave it behind and then move on, you know.
And what are you moving on to now?
I'm just off for a meeting with Movember to do, we're hopefully got this great TV idea to sort of promote what Movember is all about and people in the world. And then there's another silly motorcycle race that we're hoping to make a TV show out of. So it's nice to be back. It's been well over a year and a half, and it's just nice now that I can now actually see a future. Whereas for a long time, I had no idea what my future was going to be like and whether I could walk again at all. So, you know, it's nice. It's nice to have been able to walk into this studio and do an interview with you.
Long Way Back by Charlie Borman, published by AA, and you've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to the production team of Wei Dong Ling, George McDonough and Hester Underhill. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.